So here we are together on our religious venture. Let us sally forth. I am going to start with an excerpt from the sermon by Reverend Arneson, titled again, From One to Many. There are some among us, scholars, political scientists, clergy, who decry the allegiance people feel to their nations, to their ethnicity, their religions, to the ancient roots of their cultures. This despair at the new tribalism is, of course, influenced strongly by the human tragedies we have seen associated with these loyalties, and particularly with their violent suppression. Who among us can see any good in the continuing tragedy of the Sudan or Chechnya? These tensions and the sudden breakup of larger states into smaller nations have turned the tables on the motto that has been an inspiration for this American state. Instead of e pluribus unum, from the many, one, we seem to be living in a time when the world's motto is exactly the opposite, from the one, many. The despair we feel, therefore, goes beyond our horror at the bloodshed occurring in these specific places. The despair we feel is rooted in the perception that this new tribalism and religious exclusivity seems to be the repudiation of a fondly held dream. The dream of national and cultural boundaries dissolving. The dream of people coming together instead of splitting apart. The dream of one world. From the many, one has been a theme of liberal religion in all of its forms for generations. In all the diversity of worship, we discern one God. In all the diversity of creation, we discern one interdependent web of life. In all the diversity of beliefs and expressions, we discern one faith that has motivated the great religious teachers and leaders throughout history. This was a dream that was at the heart of the universalism that was being proclaimed in the first half of the 20th century. 50 years ago, there was no stronger voice for this religion of unities and universals than one Clarence Skinner, a preeminent universalist of the first half of the century. He combined a compelling social conscience and critical analysis of the evils of society with a mystical optimism that the unity of creation would manifest itself in the advance of humanity toward greater justice, compassion, and knowledge. Skinner's mysticism still sounds a chord that I can hear as I read his writings today, but his optimism is more difficult to embrace. There's been so much bloodied water under the bridge this past half century, too many wars, too much disappointment in the broken promises of technology, too much horror at the inhumanity of people to each other to jump on that bandwagon of optimism anymore. Can the religion of unities and universals that Skinner preached speak to the world we live in today? Or is it a religion that is hopelessly naive and deluded about the way things really are? That's the question that Arneson asks in his sermon. And I'd like now to turn a little bit in way of answer to Harvey Cox. In The Future of Faith, Cox offers up a new interpretation of the history and the future of religion. He feels that beliefs and dogma are giving way to a new grassroots movement rooted in social justice and spiritual experience. According to Cox, there's an essential change taking place in what it means to be religious today. Religious people are more interested in ethical guidelines and spiritual disciplines than they are in doctrines. The result is a trend away from the hierarchical, the regional, the patriarchal, the institutional religion. And as these changes gain momentum, they evoke an almost point-for-point fundamentalist reaction. Fundamentalism, Cox argues, is on graphic display around the world right now because it is dying and putting up a strong fight. Once suffocated by creeds, hierarchies, the disastrous merger of the church with the Roman Empire, faith, Christian faith, rather than belief, is once again becoming Christianity's defining quality. Cox feels that this move away from dogmatic religion is best explained against the backdrop of three distinct periods of church history. First of all, the Age of Faith. In the first three centuries of Christianity, when the early church was more concerned with following Jesus' teachings than enforcing what everyone should standardized, in a standardized fashion believe about Jesus. Then, according to Cox, comes the Age of Belief. This is when we made a significant shift between the 4th and the 20th centuries, and the church focused on orthodoxy and correct doctrine. The rules, following the same rules, became the most important thing. Then there's the Age of the Spirit, a trend that, according to Cox, began about 50 years ago and is increasingly directing the church of tomorrow, whereby people are ignoring dogma and breaking down barriers between different religions. Spirituality is going to replace formal religion. At least that's his view. And the optimism of this view, he's speaking as a Christian scholar, but he's speaking across all disciplines about the globalization of spirituality in a way that really appealed to me. There was something about his promising message that just really appealed to me. You know, I had tend to think about we have large evangelical churches in our community, and I have friends that attend them. I've attended with them now and then, and I remember coming out of a mega church, turning to my friend and saying, "Well, what? That's just church light, L-I-T-E." here I thought this was very fundamentalist, and she said, "No, really, the message, the aim is to get the message across to, a lot of people, not just a few. We want to sort of dilute our message so that that it'll reach a lot of people." I didn't know what to think about that one way or the other, but I found it very interesting. Is that another symptom of the Age of the Spirit, according to Cox? I don't know. These things were just ruminating in my head, and that's why I wanted Jane to take a look at this book. Anyway, back to Dr. Arneson. It is easy to forget that it has not been long since our hearts were lifted up by the crumbling of the Berlin Wall, the most powerful symbol of the ideological division which had held the world hostage for a generation. And in the midst of our enthusiasm for the freedoms that became possible with the end of the Cold War, we heard voices reminding us that this path toward a new world order would be very dangerous and very hard. They have been proven right. Yet, alongside of and in spite of the creation of vast swaths of lawless territory where criminal and terrorists have been able to take root, there are many nation-states in Eastern Europe and Asia both that have managed to move through the difficult economic adjustments of the 90s without civil war and without anarchy. Many of these former states have been accepted into the EU, joining Western Europe's system for civilized citizenship and currency. And those who have lived through World War II, ask yourself if you ever could have imagined in 1945 that before your grandchildren reached adulthood, a continent that had been so divided by war would reunite together for purposes of common good and benefit, all the while sustaining their rich and diverse cultures. It can be possible. Tribalism, ethnic pride, and nationalism are not necessarily the demons that plague our world, but they do have their demonic side. The demonic side of tribalism is the tendency to make people of other tribes into agents of the devil. It is to misunderstand the religious revelation or spiritual insight of your tribe's religion as exclusive and impossible to reconcile with that of the tribe next door. Then to fight the tribe next door becomes not only a matter of pride or self-defense, but a religious duty. All over the world, in places where religious obligation is combined with tribal economic and cultural interests, we find humanity creating hell. In its earliest forms, the pioneers of universalism saw as their task the liberation of the human mind and heart from the fear of that hell. Today, the universalism we preach does not address hell as specifically as it once did, but the world around us is still imprisoned by hell's image. In the 21st century, our universalist message is consistent with that preached by our religious ancestors when we proclaim that the face of the enemy is not that of any great Satan or his agents, but instead the face of people well known to us, people who also love their children and seek what's best for them, people who also face death with courage and wonder what lies beyond it, people whose aspirations are no different from the ones we have. The universalist message that makes sense in the 21st century can no longer be based on the belief in e pluribus unum, the many one. From the many one suggests an imposed unity, a phony syncretism, which no longer speaks to the aspirations of the many tribes and nations around the world. On the contrary, the universalist message we must embrace could be grounded instead in the motto, from the one many, the belief that from the one within the one, which is behind our human drama in all its forms, there's a place for the each of the many culture, a place for many ways of worship, a place for many revelations through which the one is manifest. Our country is a great example of this. The ideal of a liberal democracy with individual liberty and economic opportunity has attracted people of every nation and tribe to come here to make their home. This country is moving from the image of a melting pot, though, to the image of a mosaic. Yet we see a disturbing trend within the political right of this country and religious right. The strongest tribal divisions we see happening in our country today may not exist between diverse ethnic groups or denominations, and not even between the different races that make up this country. The strongest tribal division we see today may be happening between the cultures of fundamentalist conservatism and political intolerance, and the rest of the society which it demonizes. When major politicians consistently support using the views of the religious right to dominate all our laws and cultures, we should have a cause for concern. A universalism for today will have to seek the common moral ground that can transcend even persistent familiar animosities, which has helped create this great cultural division, animosities such as those around gender roles and reproductive rights. To paraphrase Christopher Lash, the circumstances of our collective insecurity in the world make it necessary for us to trust those who cannot be subjected to our control. If American politics today represents the mobilization of resentment, then universalism represents the mobilization of trust, conceived not as a favor we bestow on others, but a necessity imposed on us by our common and our shared weakness. The ever-changing technologies of communication have brought the world closer together than it's ever been, has issued in a wave of globalization like never before, and yet we know that technology itself doesn't hold the answer we seek. When ancient hatreds and personal greeds and demonizing the other all conspire to create tribal warfare and terrorism, the first thing that is sacrificed is the technology on which we're so dependent. There's a spiritual challenge that must be met for the technological miracles of which we're capable to make a difference in the world. Unitarian Universalism today speaks to that spiritual challenge. I'd like to end with a quote from the former president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, Bill Schultz. In an essay on liberal religion in the 21st century, he offers this call. Every race or nation, with their divergent appearances, customs, and interests, is a challenge to the self-sufficiency of every other. And in the face of such challenges, we forget our common roots and common tribulations. Surely one of the things about religion is to remind us not just that we are free, but that we each will die, not just that we are different, but that we are each subject to grace and capable of praise. If we are to overcome nationalism, economic exploitation, the accumulative mentality, we require a religious proclamation of that which binds us to one another, to the earth, and to the holy. Just one aside, I adore Karen Armstrong's idea of the globalization of spirituality. As we belong to bigger and more diverse groups of people, and as the world shrinks, I really do foresee a very distinct possibility that sense of healthy belonging, that sense of healthy belonging will spread outward and encompass us all. It's optimistic, it may be naive, but it's possible, and I choose to believe that it's possible.